True or false? The Signal chat that Trump was involved, which the Republican Party was involved in, and J.D. Vance was involved in, that the Atlantic have leaked, named a CIA operative. True or false?
True.
You think he did name a CIA operative?
I believe that. I would not put it past him.
Mo?
I'm going to go with true as well. I'm purely taking it out of thin air and to back up my Scottish counterpart there.
Thank you.
Madge?
What was the question, sorry?
Did, in the Signal chat, they mention the name of a CIA operative? As in someone overseas that you're not meant to mention by name.
Oh, true. That sounds like something those games would do. They didn't even know Giesel was in the chat. So you know.
It is true. Well done, everyone. Yeah. You got a point.
If this was an Ask the Audience, like...
Agent Morris in Yemen, undercover agent, has infiltrated the terrorist group.
Oh, my word.
And everyone's looking at him like, you...
Humza, this goes over to Mo. Humza Yousef has announced that he's going to introduce a second homes tax. So if you own a second homes tax. He announced that this week.
Humza Yousef?
Mm-hmm.
He's stepping down, isn't he? So I think he talked about a second homes tax when he was first minister. So I'm going to go with false because I think it was announced before.
Madge?
Oh, with true.
Jenny?
I'm afraid if it's a second home tax on the richest section, then true. If it's just a general set, then I'm going to say true. True.
It is false.
Bro, it's right. Washed.
I was taking the lead.
He's so washed.
I'm taking the lead.
He's washed.
Madge, there's a Venezuelan Venezuelan footballer was deported by ICE because he had a Real Madrid tattoo.
I'll go true. True.
True. Jenny.
Yeah, I'm going to say true. They've been pretty non-discerning in the people that they've been putting away of late.
There is an actual clip of them kidnapping a doctor on the street.
Yeah, there was a Canadian actress also held without charge for 11 days without any chance to contact anybody.
Mo?
I have no idea, so this is a shot in the dark, and I'll go with what everybody else is saying true.
It is true. Deported him to El Salvador, to a prison they've got out there.
It's because they've got quotas. Mm-hmm. They're getting bonuses for quotas of people that they pull in.
That's outrageous.
Trump has literally made it a witch hunt on people that aren't necessarily American.
That's classic American colonialism. I think they did that with Native Americans and scalps and stuff like that, to be fair. So. Yep.
Yes, yeah. Scalps. Yeah, more scalps, more money.
Yep. Give people a quota and bonus at the end of it and you're going to get shit done. Yep.
That's
America.
Final question over to Jenny. Glasgow and Edinburgh this week announced that there is going to be a 2 day a week library opening times to save money. So they're only open 2 days a week.
I have to say false because libraries are far too important to communities. I'm going to have to say false to that in the hopes that it's false.
Mo.
I'm going to go with false as well because of exactly what Jenny said. We have a lot of good stuff that goes on in libraries for people that don't have technology for getting bus passes and things like that. Like, even though we've got tech, I cheated and took my kids down to get their bus passes. It was much easier than scanning passports and things. And then my mum, she couldn't live without the library. So I really hope that it's not true.
Madge?
I'll go true.
It is false.
Fucking hell, I'm cooked.
Well done.
No, nothing.
Thank you, Scotland.
Scotland.
It's an unfair advantage. Ask them questions about Bangladesh, watch me win.
Let's get into it. Welcome everyone to the Sunday Roast, and we're back again with two lovely Scots. Jenny, please can you introduce yourself?
You all know me. I run Random Scottish History. I've published books, podcasts, rsh.scot. Have at it. It's all there for you. I've got over 250 videos on YouTube now. Just do the thing.
Mo?
My name's Mo. I am a Scottish independence activist. I am very much that since I was 12 years old, and I'm 53 now. So it's in my blood. You cut me and I bleed salt tires. I run a little channel on YouTube called Sousa Scott. I have a website called sousascott.com. I do everything. Videos, marches, blogs. Run a big team of about 100 people across Scotland for it all. Love Scotland, hate Westminster, and I love England as well. My dad's English. He's a proper East End Cockney boy, so There's no two bones about it. We're all the same people, and we're all getting exploited by the same people down south.
Feels like it after this week. Madge.
Hi, I'm Madge. I run the Big Madge Studios channel. You can check me out because I've got loads of interesting content coming up. And on this podcast, I'm with Alex, who is not Scottish, like me.
Where do we go with everything this week? I mean, we've got two Scots on, so I feel let's go with the Barnett formula. Let's stick with that to begin with and talk about what that is, what it does, and the damage that it potentially can cause. Mo, can you give our viewers a sort of sounding off as to what
sure,
it is and what
sure.
it does? And
so where the devolved nations get their funding from, allegedly, is from this thing called the Barnett Formula. And the Barnett Formula started in the 1970s. I think it was 1978 that it was originally set up. And that was to sort of like divvy up the money for the different sort of areas. This is before devolution. Now, what it does, in its essence, the easiest way to describe it is that all your revenue from Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland gets sent down to the Treasury. And there's all these boffins that like to use a spreadsheet or a formula to decide how much is going to come back from the money that went south into the Treasury. And it's done as a sort of a percentage per head of population. And then it's done for maybe you might get a little bit more in here or there as it goes through this formula. So to give you an example of how this works for Scotland is we in 23-24 we raised about 87.5 billion in revenue. We sent that south. We got 41 billion back in our block grant for all of our devolved powers and different things going on. Westminster spent 30 billion on our behalf for the things maybe like defence or other sort of other welfare issues like pensions and stuff like that. Then that left about 16 billion left over. Great, that's a surplus. But however, when you look at JERS that year, it says we were £22 billion in public spending deficit. And that £22 billion is not spent on Scottish public services. Not a chance, because we would have the greatest public services you could possibly imagine if that was the case, right? So we send the money, they decide how much we're going to get back, and it goes there. Now, if at any time there's cuts to public services in England, done by Westminster, say for the health service, that then affects Scotland. So if, for instance, Keir Starmer decides we're going to spend less on health service, they have less per head of population getting spent, so Scotland gets less and less and less. So if there's more privatisation going on with the NHS in England, they have less money going to that, so we get less money, but we're not privatising. So this is where a lot of people turn around and say, hey, look, you know, you get a lot of money from Westminster, but we don't. We send more down than we get back. We spend less than what we have sent, okay? And I can tell you where that 22 billion public service deficit comes from, and it's quite interesting, right? So we have to pay a share of around about 8.1% of a lot of things that don't affect Scotland. So again, using 23-24 as the example, there was £265 billion spent on quangos down south. Quangos being your non-governmental sort of entities. It could be public parks, it could be the museums, it could be anything at all. Just all your non-sort of governmental department things. Now, 8.1% of £265 billion is round about £21.5 billion, which is too damn close for my liking to be that £22 billion. And it is deemed as public service spending. So I think they rounded it up, put it in jars and says, hey, you've got a deficit of £22 billion. You're rubbish. Scotland bad. Scotland bad. And we get that all the time, all the time. So this budget, which I think we should be talking about as well, okay, will have a knock-on effect over the next couple of years into Scotland with our spending. And my question is to everybody here just now, is why can't Scotland keep all its money? Why can't we spend everything that we earn?
Jenny?
Just on the issue of the quangos, across the board, like everyone is coming out again about the fact that getting rid of NHS England is getting rid of one of the world's largest quangos, which is quasi-autonomous non-governmental organisation. And
NHS England.
Which is fine, but At the same time, Labour, since coming to power, have set up 27 quangos. So, wow. That's where a lot of money is being put into as well.
So they might be claiming some back from
killing off their world's biggest quango.
I think she did, didn't she? A non-governmental thing. Didn't you mention quangos?
It's a quasi-autonomous, non-governmental organisation is what quango stands for.
And they have a different role that they're given to be able to administer whatever it is. So whether it's the NHS in England or they're not like a consultancy group or anything like that, are they?
They're out with the government.
It's admin. And then it's given that public-private status so you can manipulate the best out of public and the best out of private, supposedly.
Yeah. I mean, the Scottish NHS is governmentally owned. Scottish NHS, that's a government organisation. I don't believe that Scotland has a huge amount of quangos on the go.
I can give you an example of a Scottish one. Scottish one would be like the National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh. They get government funding, okay, and they're considered to be a quango. But you can't imagine Scotland without the National Museum. You can't imagine England without the Victoria Albert Museum. These things are necessary. They need to have some sort of funding. Otherwise, they become somewhere where you might have to pay to get into. And we don't want the history of our heritage to be, you know, not available to the public for a certain extent anyway.
I mean, that's part of the reason why they were created in the first place, was to offer up an education facility to the public, both museums and libraries. I think the libraries are struggling a little bit because, you know, the generation coming through, it doesn't read as much as probably we would like, but you can still use those spaces for an educational purpose. It's just repurposing it in a more modern era. Definitely keep the books, though. I mean, they just look great in the background.
There's plenty of groups and childcare services and whatever that operate out of libraries, as well as your opportunities to read and research and study. Yeah.
Sometimes MPs use them as well for MP surgeries. Yeah. Also, you just play board games there when they don't lose all the pieces.
So when you're looking at this Barnett, interestingly, I looked it up. Even the creator of the Barnett formula thought it was rubbish.
Yeah.
But his point was more it didn't deal with people's needs. It only dealt with the proportion. Whereas I feel like, Mo, you're saying, actually, why are we giving all this money? Why can't we just keep it?
Like Mo says, it was like a stopgap until something better was devised.
That's what he said as well, actually. I listened to an interview with him about it today, being like, it just took a load of pressure off me. I think he was the chief minister of finance. And he was like, because I had this simple formula, I didn't have to keep faffing around with it every year. And therefore, I could go and concentrate on other things. And then he started bragging about how he put in cuts. And we can all guess what party that was. But go on. I can see you want to say something.
We can't guess because they could be the same party now. It's a 50-50. It's 50-50, lad. The game has changed.
They are the red Tories up here. We keep
Very
telling.
Much. So give you an example again about how dated the Barnett formula is. It doesn't consider specific needs. Wales has different needs than Scotland does. Northern Ireland has different needs than Wales. And even England has different needs from the rest of us as well. So, for instance, we've got a very rural population as well. So getting an ambulance to somebody that lives in a croft might be an air ambulance, which might cost a little bit more. This is why when they look at spending, if you look at like the big urban sort of centres around England, it's easier to do per head of population there because the facilities are quite close. When you have a dispersed rural population, apart from the central belt in Scotland, say, okay, you do have to spend a little bit more, and we get that, okay? But the Barnett formula does not take that into account the way that it should do, okay? We do get other consequentials, that's what it's called. We do get some other spending, and they like to say that you're getting a record amount of money this time. Yeah, we are. In cash value, we're getting a good chunk. Right. But as a percentage compared to previous budget years, we're actually getting less.
Do you think that message goes through to the Scottish people?
No.
As much as it, what,
and
why do you think
nuanced.
That is?
It's such a thing to try and describe to people that by the time you're 2 minutes in, people are like tuned out and they're already thinking about other things. Like
down to the fact that everything's busy. I was looking at the stats and figures earlier. Because, I mean, there's other stuff we're going to talk about today, which included land reform, which also ties into this slightly. But I was looking at, I mean, strangely enough, I think for wages, you guys have done slightly better than England, at least in the public sector. So I was having a look at the last 20 years in terms of wage rises. We talked about this last week. I think Scotland's had over the last 20 years, 11% increase in public. I think it's 7% in private.
You know how your government keeps wailing about your doctors and nurses and skilled staff going over to Canada and Australia and places that are prepared to pay them more? They fail to tell you that Scotland is also robbing England of its nurses and doctors because they're paid better up here.
We've got a massive brain drain, which no one's talking about, but it's a twofold.
Scotland's had that since 1603.
Which is why leaving the EU was so devastating, because you guys were recruiting from the EU, like, quite easily. I mean, compared to now. And then your ability to import your ability to bring people in through migration has been greatly restricted, because it's now entirely up to Westminster.
That's been a continuous Scottish complaint, though, the fact that the overwhelming anti-immigration rhetoric from Westminster, which has been on the go for decades now, completely goes against everything that Scotland stands for and requires. We keep saying, you, by all means, like, limit the immigration as far as England's concerned. If that's what you want, if you feel like you're overpopulated and you don't need the workforce from outside, that's fine. Legislate for yourselves, but devolve the ability for us to regulate our own immigration, and it's never happened.
I do wonder how they would do that, because I don't think there's any country that has devolved immigration like that.
It's something that needs to be worked out, though, because it is purely detrimental to our country.
But then again, you're saying the same thing with the word country. We're a union. And this is the thing that I never seem to get. It's really interesting in the wordplay that you use.
That's the biggest lie, is that Great Britain or the UK is a country. It's not. It's no more a country than the EU is a country. People in France, when asked what their nationality is, don't go, "Oh, I'm European." Yet you've got people all over Britain who are unionists going, "I'm British." It's like,
do you?
Where were you born?
Do you have that? Where were you born? Like, you might.
If you're born
it,
in Scotland, you're Scottish. If you're born in Wales, you're from Wales. If you're born in England, you're English. Like, you're no British unless you were born on the border, like with your legs in one and you're heaving another. You know,
like. Do you get that? Just to clarify, then, you're saying that you don't get many people saying British
up here. Far less than used to be. Up here, you're going to get a lot more Scottish before British. And even when it comes to websites, like when you're purchasing anything for any website or doing anything, registering for anything, and it comes up with country, guaranteed a good 70% of us are going to look for Scotland before we start trying to find Great Britain or UK.
When you guys do your YouTube videos, what do you put down as the location?
I put Glasgow.
You put Glasgow?
Mine? Yeah. But it comes up Glasgow, UK, which fucking...
It would be interesting to have the choice to say that we can put down Scotland rather than Britain or the United Kingdom.
But do you put that in your YouTube video? Sorry, there is a reason I'm asking this. What do you put
down? I have to say, when it comes to, like, you know, you like schedule a video to go out and it asks for your time zone, I do put Dublin before Scotland, before London.
I'm going to start doing that. I've never done that before. I just do local time.
Oh no, I always go for Dublin just to make a fucking point.
Oh, I'm doing that from now on.
What do you put, Madge?
I have no idea. I genuinely
never put the location down.
I press button and it uploads video to local time, I guess. I'm like, bro, I work full time. I ain't got time to check this stuff, I'll be honest. So I'm just, I click button. If I don't see the video uploading, I cry because I probably hit the next day. And then that's about it. That is my process. If I see the video in my notification feed, I'm like, yes, that's a win.
And that's it.
Yep.
I normally put Europe. That's what I put down, which seems to make a lot of sense because I clearly have a European following on my channel. So I'm like, why would I not say that the location is Europe? Because then I would assume YouTube would push out. That's why I was a bit curious as to what you put.
Can I ask you a question then? Okay, you said earlier on that you couldn't get your head around saying that we're not British.
No. I don't think I quite said that. I think I said, do you say that or do you not? That was more
all right.
I was curious about.
Okay, so I think then maybe what I was trying to say was, for the same reasons, then why do you put Europe down compared to Britain? Just because of the following?
Just because of the following.
Right.
And I mean, there's also, I guess there is also a sense, look, we're in Europe. I mean, it's like... You can't say that Japan is in Japan. It's in the same context. You'd say it's in Asia. I hope.
Yeah, regardless of whether we're in the Union, we're still on the continent of Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought we left that in 2016. It's crazy.
Yeah. We just sailed away.
Do you think this is the type of stuff that really galvanizes you guys for your independence, for the independence movement that you're pushing for?
I think it's the positivity that comes from the independence movement. Like, as a former no voting Tory, which yous all know, I know, Bo's like, who changed their mind before the 2014 referendum and I voted yes. Thank you very much. And I'm an SNP member and very on side. What am I trying to say?
There's a lot to do
when I started studying Scottish history, and when you learn about something, you learn to love it and want the best for it. So when I started studying Scottish history and started actually learning about my country, which you don't get in schools in Scotland, it's a British history you get. You will be taught about Henry VIII and his wives and Elizabeth I and her Armada and the Great Fire of London before you're taught about who was on the throne in Scotland at the same time, if you even are. You're never told about the Great Fire at Edinburgh that was far more contemporary and just as destructive. You don't hear about any of that. So when I started learning about Scotland and got on side with the fact that the rhetoric I'd been given growing up that Scotland was going to become the non-PC term of a third world country should we split from the Union, when I changed my viewpoint and actually started interacting with the pro-independence side as one of them, it was such a revelation just as to how positive the movement was. Suddenly, it wasn't Scotland can't do this and it's too wee and it's too poor and how could we survive without all the benefits we get from Westminster, instead of like constantly putting your country down, which is all the unionists have. You cannot be a unionist in Scotland and be pro-Scotland. When I checked it, just the sheer positivity was overwhelming, and it really struck me. And what was so interesting after doing the Treaty of Union articles, publication and YouTube stuff, was the fact that prior to the World Wars, the majority of Scots, like over 90% of Scots, were pro-Union Scottish nationalists. That they were only pro-Union on the basis that it would benefit Scotland. And they fought tooth and nail for that. They fought against centralisation. They fought for every penny. The fact that between 1861 and 1891, we were underfunded and overtaxed to the extent of 131 odd million pounds, which in today's money is like something like 3 or 4 billion pounds in the space of 30 years at the end of the 19th century. And you're just like, so if Scotland had that amount of money to be robbed of, what could we have done for ourselves? What would our country and population and civilization look like now had we been left to our own devices?
Norway?
You know? Exactly.
Norway. It always blows my mind that no one sets up a sovereign wealth fund. I have no clue as to why that's still not being done. And
I think it's because of the crown.
Put it all down the toilet before it can be put into a fund for anything. You've got the Tories spaffing how many billions? Just in the period of the pandemic, how many billions were spaffed up the wall by the Tories?
Hundreds.
None of that can be put into a fund for anything.
Nope. Nor would it.
I think with that, it's because of the crown. Because if you look at the sovereign wealth fund for Norway, it's predominantly oil based, and the oil money around the UK goes to the crown. The crown owns all of the oil. We had this question on a quiz before. I'm pretty sure they sell it.
They
off,
own the seabed, so they get
which is where the oil is.
But I wonder. I don't think the Norwegian king owns their seabed. So yeah, I think it's state owned.
It'll be state owned.
They've got a different system over there.
But that's what I mean. Their monarchy system's different to ours. So because of the crown. The Crown Estate, they get the money instead of us. Just like all the buildings and stuff, they could have done a sovereign wealth fund with all of the buildings that they own and use it for tourism. Just like, you know, you can go to the Sisselenhof Palace. I got that one wrong last time I mentioned it, but I'm pretty sure it's that one in Berlin. You can go there, pay €15, and you can go check it out. And I recommend it if you're in Berlin. It's cool as hell. That area is really nice.
I'm 100% positive. If we got self-determination, the majority would then vote for a republic, ditch that fucking king, and we would take our own resources back.
Whoa, he's just been put in hospital. You can't say that.
Screw that guy.
Whoa. But anyways, it's like like yeah, Palace of Versailles, like a heritage site as well. So a lot of the things the Crown owns would be like probably heritage sites where people pay like a couple of quid to go in, like a tenner or something like that. You can go check it out and see everything properly. Like I said, the Palace, really nice. Went there a couple of years ago. I might try and go back maybe at some point. I will
Or
show
it would
people all my
end
cool
up under
pictures.
organizations like Historic Scotland or National Trust, where you just get a membership, you can just go free to all of them. And yeah, it would just become like super touristy and it would be a money maker.
Gomo.
I have a Historic Scotland pass as well.
Good
Best
luck.
investment I've ever had, ever. We've
National
ticking
Trust
off
as well.
castles every summer. As many castles as
Well,
possible. Ticking it off, ticking it off. And we
me
got
and
the
Aki's
one.
mad go out every week to get around as many as possible. We're in Melrose today, which is
Oh,
Historic
wow.
Scotland.
You realize I'm
Historic
now going to
Scotland.
have to make sure there's B-roll for every single one of these castles that you've mentioned.
That's a good
It's
idea.
not a sponsored video.
It'll be a nice little image for everyone to have a look at. I want to move on a little bit towards, I think, land reform, which is pretty important, and combine it with a bit on austerity, and then we might have a bit of time to talk about Trump as well. I think we'll go on to land reform first, because I'm quite interested at this, because this is quite unique. Can you give us a Jenny, can you give us the percentages for
Well, what I'll
ownership
do is
in
I'll tell you the
Scotland?
state of play in 1894. I'll
Yeah.
tell you what the Land Reform Review in 2014 found, and I'll give a wee bit of what was discussed yesterday, just to give you a kind of timeline of how it's changed, I guess. So, from the Edinburgh Evening News, which was Thursday the 8th of February 1894, page 2 of that paper. It tells us that the total acreage of Scotland is 18,946,694 acres, and one owner alone had 1,326,000 acres in Scotland and also 32,095 in England, or a total of 1,358,548 acres. 12 owners have 4,339,722 acres, or nearly one quarter of the whole of Scotland. Or, in other words, a tract of country larger than the whole of Wales and equal in size to 8 English counties, the Bedfordshire, Berkshire, Buckinghamshire, Cambridgeshire, Cheshire, Cornwall, Cumberland, and Derbyshire. This is startling enough, but let us proceed. 70 owners have about 9,400,000 acres, or about one half of Scotland, while nine
Sorry,
tenths of the whole.
say that again. Nine owners had half of Scotland, nine families.
70 owners have about
Right.
9,400,000 acres, or about one half of Scotland, while nine tenths of the whole of Scotland, that is, of the whole of 18,946,694 acres, belong to fewer than 1,700 persons. Then we get to a bit of an update, the Land Reform Review of 2014. We were told a government survey in 1872 found that 90% of Scotland's land area of 7.9 million hectares was owned by 1,380 private landowners. Studies in the 1970s showed that 100 years on, less than 1,500 large-scale private landowners still owned 60% of Scotland's land area. It is claimed that currently 432 private landowners own 50% of the private land in rural Scotland. The latest estimate of Scotland's population is 5,327,000. So this means that half of a fundamental resource for the country is owned by 0.008% of the population. As a measure of inequality in a modern democracy, this is exceptional and is in need of explanation. The activity of the Danish businessman Anders Povlsen, who we fucking love, who has purchased six large estates in recent years to become Scotland's second largest landowner with around 65,000 hectares, has also contributed to this apparent reconcentration. And this case also illustrates just how readily the reconcentration of ownership can occur. And that man also allows hunting on his private grounds, which you can do out with the law.
As in, any person can knock on the door and say, "Can I come in and hunt?" And he goes, "Yep."
He tends to invite people
Right.
to organized hunts on his land, as far as I'm aware. Now, I've got written notes from yesterday's. So, this was the stage one debate on Land Reform Scotland Bill, and it was proposed by Mari Gurjon. And she did make the point that Eigg and Ascent have actually been successful in obtaining communal ownership of their land. So it is possible. And
so
they,
what does communal mean exactly?
The community as a whole have bought the land on which they reside and work and operate.
Wow. So a group of you could turn up and just purchase that land in theory, and that would be communal property.
Yeah. So
and
the
then
problem
you could develop
is
it between your community.
Yeah, the problem is that when a large tract of land in Scotland goes up for sale, often the community aren't alerted to the fact, and it goes up for private bids, private sale. So this reform bill aims to make the whole process far more transparent and give communities far more time in order to get together and discuss whether they have the means and desire to actually obtain the land for themselves. It's part of the land reform bill that's been talked about at the moment. Obviously, Tory stood up and decided, no, he's very against that. But do you know, one thing that I did notice in the debate yesterday on land reform, which was, it struck me as a good thing, was that every time an MSP stood up to ask a question or give their view, they started by outing where their interest lay. So if they were a farm owner, if they were if they had tenants on their land, etc., they would make that known before they would then give their point of view on a thing. And I think that should be done more for MPs in Westminster, out their interest. So
transparency is key. Yeah.
So
that would be funny, actually. Can you imagine West Streeting turning around and sort of saying, right, okay, we're going to be talking about NHS today. Just to let you know, I've got my fingers in the pies of many different private organisations for it.
By
so
private,
let's now talk transparency.
Yeah. You should have it sewn on its arm like that. Badge.
It's just because we're talking about Norway. Do you know that you were able to look at your neighbour's finances? Like, everything's out on the table in Norway. Like, you can't hide
they
how much
also,
you're earning.
There's a lot to do with your earnings in Norway, isn't it? It's like, so if you get caught with a traffic violation, you're literally, your fine is based on a percentage of your earnings. So if you're rather wealthy,
Finland.
You can end up paying like 100,000.
I think that's Finland.
Is it
I think
Finland?
It's Finland. I think it's Finland
I
that does
love that.
That. Isn't it amazing? Yeah, because like...
Hey, that's a way to raise money, isn't it?
Yeah,
so Marie Goujon continues telling us that Scotland has one of the most concentrated patterns of land ownership in the world, that 421 landowners at present own 50% of rural land in Scotland. Kevin Stewart added to that and noted that that was actually 440 in 2012. So we've got less people than in 2012 owning that 50%. Which showed that we've actually gone backwards, which obviously needs rectified. And that in Europe, more diversified land ownership is the norm. That in many countries, Norway, Scandinavia, America, across Europe, you'll find that people have second homes in their country, somewhere that they can escape to for time away. You don't get that in Britain, unless you're very rich.
I guess that sort of... That
there's
touches...
not the opportunity for that, as there would be if it was more fairly split and more diversified, like they're attempting to attain.
That sort of touches on what Gary Stevenson, I don't know if you guys are aware of him, he's been campaigning, he's a millionaire trader who now wants to have a massive tax done on the rich. But he's been saying that wealth inequality has been going up ever since COVID. And if not before that, and that sort of ties in quite well with that. You know, if there's fewer landowners, that means the wealth is concentrating in more and more people. That's more evidence to show that's been going on. Mo, what are your thoughts on, is that it, Jenny? Sorry.
Yes, I'm happy with outing that amount of information.
I was just going to say, you know that like it was funny that you were talking as a percentage how much you like with Finland. There are guys who constantly drive up and down Knightsbridge in London, drag racing millionaires, and they get there like supposedly from oil rich countries, I'll say that much, and apparently they'll just have the car confiscated and they'll just go off and buy a new one. They couldn't care less because it's chump change. But if it's a percentage,
this goes along with the idea that any laws that are enacted without jail sentence that are based purely on you're fined x amount if you do this thing basically means you can do this thing as long as you can pay this amount to do that thing.
Yes, pretty much. Mo, what are your thoughts on the land reform?
I think We need to reform the living daylights out of it. It's the Scottish people's land, and people can own land, absolutely, don't get me wrong, okay? But not at the amount that Jenny's talking about. Okay.
This
There's
all
that.
comes off the back of the clearances.
Yeah.
This is just a long-lasting effect of the manufactured clearances of the end of the 18th up to the late mid-19th
Can you give a brief
century.
description to the audience what the clearances were?
The clearances, it came out of absentee landlordism. So in 1603, when James VI went down and became James I in England, he brought a lot of the nobles with him to this new centralized seat of power. And those nobles were going to have owned lands with tenants on them, and so they became absentee landlords. Then, after the Union, again, you had even more of the lords and landed gentry going down to London to join this again renewed centralized seat of government in order to participate in all of these. And they no longer cared about the people because that whole thing about absence makes the heart grow fonder. Not if it's your tenants you're talking about, because it made them completely uninterested in how they were getting on. They were making new friends. So Scotland has always been really frugal with how they've spent their money, and even down to your lords and your gentry in Scotland, they were always spent within their means. When the union was signed off, England entered that union with £20 million worth of debt already, which translates to 3 billion odd today. And Scotland took on half that debt on entering the union, as a boon of doing that. Scotland entered the union with no public debt. So these landlords, these nobles, these people that had fled down to the seat of power at London, they were suddenly mingling with all of these ostentatious English not lords that would just spend hand over fist and didn't really live within their means to a certain extent. And they tried to keep up with the Joneses. They wanted to be one of these English lords. They felt like, oh, this is a life that I can now have now that we're down here. So in doing that, they wanted to also bring their English friends up to Scotland to see their lands and their beautiful countrysides and their hunting forests and the salmon in their rivers, etc. But who wants to do that when you have these dirty peasants living and working on the land and living there, etc.? So, what I mean by manufactured is that there were instances where landlords, the lords of the land, would say, okay, we want to evict you, but if you're able to pay X amount of rent to me by this date, then you'll get to stay. So the people would go to market and like try and sell their cattle and everything. Prior to doing that, the factors of the lord had gone to the market and told everybody, if you buy anything from these people, you're going to be done. We're going to come down on you. So the tenants would go try and sell their wares, their cattle and everything. The cattle came to about £6 in about the kind of early 19th century each. So they would go to the market, try and sell their and no one would buy anything from them because they had been warned off. So then they would have to sell the cattle to the lord, who would buy them at half price, meaning that they didn't have the money to then pay him what they needed.
So
And
you could
in
then clear
being
them off the land.
In arrears to your lord meant that he was allowed to then call in the law to evict you. That was one part of it. Another part of it was the lords, these same insidious arseholes, would tell the people, listen, I can guarantee you a better life in Canada. We've got everything sorted for you. We will take your crops and the valuation of your crops and holdings. And that will pay for your trip to go over there. So you won't owe us anything for the travel. Everything's set up when you go over there. You get to, there'll be someone waiting for you in order to then take you to land that will be yours, that's been set aside for you. All of the amenities, you'll be set up for life. And some of the people went for it. Other people needed to be handcuffed and dragged onto boats. And families were split up through this. Others would escape into the mountains just to escape being transported in that way. And so families were just split up and around, and people would die in the attempt. And when they got to Quebec, there are news reports out of Quebec saying, we have just had 2,000 Scots come from this one part of Scotland who've arrived. They're half dead, they're half starved, and we have no provisions. We didn't know they were coming. The hell is this? And they had to go on basically forced marches into Upper Canada just to attain any kind of means of supporting themselves and finding work. And a lot of them were sent over towards the winter when they were trekking in Canadian winters.
Were the Lords getting a kickback for sending them over to Canada? They just wanted them off the land.
They wanted the land. So what they would do is actually they would take bids on the land, or they would have friends say, oh, I would quite like this extent of land that you have. And they'd go, you can have it. Guaranteed, like promise that person there would be money exchanged. And that's before the tenants have even been told, by the way, you're out.
Did they not have forced clearances with like the Redcoats as well, and like military roads to march them down and stuff like that?
The military weren't often called in. It had to get to proper rioting before the military were brought in. And that's the kind of thing that you found in Durness and Sutherlandshire.
Right.
Sutherlandshire was a real hotbed of shit when it came to the clearances. The people were so destitute, and the Duchess of Sutherland, literally, when even like organizations in England were raising money to help these poor people they kept hearing about up in Scotland, the Duchess of Sutherland went, no, see the portion that you've set aside for Sutherland, don't you worry about it. We'll take care of our tenants. We'll do for them. And she seemed really beneficial and such a wonderful person that she was going to take care of her tenants and the population that lived on her land. She didn't. The grain that was sent up was given to the animals until it rotted, and at that point it was given to the people. The people also had to pay for the Duke of Hamilton statue. So, but they had to pay for that statue before they were allowed to buy food, and the sellers were told, these people haven't paid yet. You're not allowed to sell them any grain. You're not allowed to sell them anything. So, I mean, people are quite up in arms about that statue of Sutherland, quite rightly, because it was obtained by horrific and devious means that killed people, that starved people and their families to death. But I don't think it should be got rid of. I think it should be turned into a memorial for those people that paid for it, really, and stand as a memorial to that. I could talk about the clearances for hours, mate, so you don't want to get me started on this.
Holy shit.
So, yeah, land reform, yeah?
Land reform. But that's where it started. That's where it started.
All from the clearances, and that's how they sort of
it was really
that land.
I think, see, the 15 and 45 rebellions led to a spirit of vengeance on the part of the English and Westminster. And I think at that point, it made them see Scots even as lesser humans than they had ever seen them before. I think they literally saw them as just pests that were only going to continue causing hassle, and the better they can get rid of. There's also the fact that so many Scots, it was literally a landowner's duty to raise armies out of the people on their land. That was part of their job to do that. And these boys would be sent with the British army into foreign wars abroad and come back only to find that their villages were gone, their family were gone. There was nothing left of where they'd come from.
It's
horrific. Like,
definitely, I'd not say it's an academic thing. I'd say it's a theory at the moment. But the idea is that part of the reason why you have attitudes in American business and in English, it's sort of thing of, I can only say English, I can't comment on the lords and the gentry in Scotland because I'm not aware of it as much. This idea of a stiff upper lip is this sort of transactional nature that has come out of Britain and America. So in order to deal, like if you read about Europeans or if you read about the Japanese and how they do business, it's very culturally centered around family. I mean, Japanese specifically. Whereas from what I've heard and read, American, I'm talking big deals here, American transactional is very, American businesses can be very transactional. It's less family orientated. Same with the British. And sort of when you tell me stories like that, you start to go, well, the only way you could really deal with something like that and not give a shit about any of those people is basically to shut your emotions off, which is what the, one of the arguments that you hear for why in modern era you have this attitude towards business being transactional in some parts of the world and less so in other.
When I talk about that it was the lord of the land's duty to raise an army, they had a lot of duties that were tied to their ability to own the land. They were given that land on a number of conditions, one of which was to be able to raise an army whenever it was required. But they had to ensure that education was funded on their land. They had to ensure that churches were maintained on their land. They had to have a part in maintaining the poor in their land. So by getting rid of all those people, suddenly they're saving money because they're not having to spend on education, churches, or the poor, because those people are gone and have been replaced with sheep and cattle.
I'm gonna bring in Madge just because you brought in the poor. Does this ring any bells to the?
Is Madge
does this
poor?
Bring,
wow!
Does this, wow! Does this ring any bells, Madge, with what's going on recently?
Why do you say fuck me for?
Well, you haven't spoken in fucking ages.
Yeah, you said speaking of the poor. Let's cut to this guy.
just because we bring, I mean, you know, it's again that disdain for poverty and everything else, and we wanted to talk about austerity and labor and what they brought in this week.
Yeah,
and how they're bringing in 250,000 people into poverty. 50,000 of those are being children.
Wait, you're talking about the Conservative Party, right?
Yeah, sure. Right, isn't that the same one? The same now,
right?
Red Tories.
But no, I did see there was a piece by Newsnight I was watching earlier. They're talking about, you know, is this austerity again? And it depends on how you define it. The Google definition is, you know, hardship created to, you know, reach a certain budget threshold. I've got the definition here. Difficult economic conditions created by government measures to reduce public expenditure. Now, if anyone argues we do not have that now, then you're fucking stupid. Unless your definition of austerity is to do with budget spending. But then, you know, some years we had austerity under the Conservatives, some years we didn't. Like, that doesn't make sense. As a definition,
Labour in Scotland, Anna Sarwar says, no, it's definitely not austerity. Yeah. It's like spending's up. This is all over the papers up here. No.
That's what I mean. I can send you the clip, to be fair, Alex. It's probably worth listening to, or you just steal the graph.
Rachel Reeves.
Rachel Reeves was saying, you know, they kept saying it's no return to austerity. And I've seen a lot of the pro-Labour people say, oh, it's not a return to austerity. And it's like, I don't know, cutting benefits and things like that seems to be austerity, you know, cutting Ministry of Justice and other departments in real terms, that feels like austerity, especially given the Ministry of Justice is completely cooked as is. Speaking of poor, more people being put into poverty by 2030, I think they're saying people are going to be worse off. Mm. And the party haven't done a lot apart from saying they're going to build houses. Like, that's nice. I won't be able to afford one, so it doesn't really help me that much. And just mean there'll be more annoying people around where I live. So yeah, thanks guys. But ultimately, like, it's not looking good for people. Like the worst people, not the worst people, sorry, the most vulnerable in society. I saw No Justice did a clip talking about how this is the easy decisions. Going against rich people, that's the tough choice. That's the hard decision. That's true, to be fair, because they can lobby and they have you know, groups in their interest. You know, the fact that they weaken the non-dom rules because they were lobbied by people that were non-doms, it's like, okay. And, you know, people who argue the rich are going to leave and whatever, it's like, they're already leaving, guys. Like, if their business interests are here, they're going to stay. If their business interests are elsewhere, they're going to go. You know, the argument of we need to... I saw them talking about, you know, getting rid of the digital service tax in the hopes that Trump doesn't tariff us. Is like, he's probably going to do that anyway, guys. Like, let's be honest. He's going after everyone. He's trying to make a big show of it. You know, the UK is the most cucked mentality I've ever seen, that we're going to give all these American corporations all of these benefits in the hopes he doesn't tariff us. It's like, no, it's like, you talk to the guy and you try and cut a deal. Like, you don't do all this nonsense in the hopes that he sees you. So notice me, guy. That's what they want. It's tragic.
So the EU goes, we'll put, all right, you got to do that. We'll retaliate and put 26 billion on you. Go fuck yourself. And Rachel Reeves goes and begs that he doesn't do it.
Yeah, I've got you.
That is our best stance. That is the Brexit bonus they all promised.
You got here. They're preparing to scrap the digital service tax. It's just the 2% tax on US tech companies, you know, Amazon, Google, and things like that. And, you know, people try to argue that, you know, it's a good idea in the hopes that we don't get hit by tariffs by America. It's going to do it anyways. Like, it's gonna happen. Unless we give him some ridiculous deals and stuff like that. I just don't get it. So, you know, the UK is, you know...
He gets a state visit. They'll get rid of the tariffs, won't it?
Probably. I mean, if you say some nice shit about him, yeah.
Two state visits, because it worked so well the first time, you had to do it again.
I just, from what I've seen about this budget, it's just she's kept the numbers exactly the same as October by cutting, you know, essentially entitlements, you know, welfare and things like that. And that budget in October wasn't great anyways. You know, there wasn't a ton in there. And, you know, I said it over a year ago, the fiscal rule is a complete nonsense, and she keeps talking about it. And that's what's going to destroy them in the end. It's this stupid fiscal rule, because they can't borrow more money. That's the problem. You know, other countries have run higher debt to GDP than us. France, for example. You know, you don't see everyone saying, oh, France is going to collapse, guys, it's over. It just doesn't make sense. Like, we are very weak to the bond markets because of the nature of why our system set up compared to other countries. But it's ridiculous. Like, you're going to tank the economy further by cutting benefits, cutting money from people who are going to spend money in the economy. You know, the idea, you know, I sent you that meme last week of Labour gone from the party of workers to the party of work. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people said you're not going to get people back into work by cutting the only money they have for accessibility. Like, you know, there was a guy who has, I think it was autism on Politics Live last week or the week before, where he said, like, I use that money to get therapy to help me manage my autism. It's like, well done, guys. You've just cut money from him. So now he can't see the therapist he needs, and he can't get an NHS one because we don't fucking have any. So, you know, congratulations. You've just made that guy's life worse. And for what? Like, well, what have you achieved doing this?
According to Rachel Reeves, she made the analogy today of, well, you know, if you've got a child.
Yeah.
That
fucking Harry Potter looking goon said that. And then he had to take it back. Because he said that was the wrong analogy. It's like, oh, if I have a kid and I say to my kid, oh, I'm going to stop your pocket money and you're going to have to get a Saturday job. It's like, Darren, mate, what if your kid's legs don't work? Or what if your kid literally can't get a job because of mental health? You absolute moron. And he had to roll back that statement. So, you know, Darren, she said it again today because she apparently said it was the wrong thing.
Mo, what are your thoughts?
Crazy.
I think that it's awful. My son's autistic. Right. I've got four kids and my youngest is autistic. And when you hear stories like what Madge is saying there just now, it's heartbreaking. Both me and my wife work, so we're okay. We do get a bit of DLE to help with him. And we're both concerned because we put that straight into things that he needs straight away. I think that everything that's happened with Labour, I mean, first they voted not to get rid of the two-child benefit cap. Then it was like the WASPI woman, and then it was the pensioners, and now it's the people that are disabled. I mean, what is going on with this? It's the whole thing is outrageous to save some fiscal policy, to save some money, okay? But they're quite happy to put defence spending up. You know, they reduce from one area and then they increase in another over the time period of the next 5 years. It's not right. It's not right at all. And then you've got the encouragement of the young people can have a great career in the defence industry. Okay, so it goes from the budget to all the grey area about where the money is going to go, where they're saving, but they're going to increase. Why can they increase that and not increase things for the people and then encourage the young people to go into the defence sector?
Well, I mean, This is what we touched. It's amazing how this has sort of gone full circle, because we were talking about people moving over to Scotland. We've got a brain drain of 500,000 leaving a year. Mm. But you mentioned young people. The birth rate's fucked. It's 1.44. When we need it at 2.1. Mm. We're well off that mark. They have not brought in any policy to help with that. In fact, they've demanded that you only have the 2-child cap on. That's it. No more. And yet we need more kids. To make it's just short-minded, short-term thinking. That's just devastating to the economy. Nothing's going to get fixed, in my opinion. Go on, Matt.
I think with the defense point as well, we have some of the highest energy costs in the world. I saw NJ talking about that as well. So it's like, how are you going to manufacture all of these really expensive things? Our manufacturing sector is knackered. Where are you going to import these raw materials from? And then, you know, who are you going to sell these weapons to? Because the EU have already got a procurement scheme for weapons. Yeah. No way you're selling it to America. Who are you selling these guns to? Yeah, we're excluded. Yeah, because we're not in the team or not on, you know,
not in the EU.
Exactly. And, you know, Norway's in there because, you know, they've got an agreement. They've had an agreement, I think, since like 2004. But we're not in the team. So who are you going to sell these weapons to? So we have the highest energy costs. We have, you know, we don't have a strong kind of education system for things like manufacturing. So that's not going to work. So this idea, you know, it's like the Conservatives said, oh, you know, this person's a ballet dancer, but they've got a job in cyber. It's literally the same thing. it's even more stupid if you're building your plan off that, because the Conservatives did it as just a kind of like rhetorical point more than anything. And I think with the austerity stuff as well, like we discussed the two-child cap, that's not a thing in Scotland, right? The bedroom tax, that's not a thing in Scotland, right? So I think it does go back to kind of the topic I actually wanted to discuss, which is what can the SNP really do, or what can Scotland really do about Labour's cuts that are coming in? Because these are Labour Party cuts that are coming in. Absolutely. You know, this is a decision, you know. Learn that watching the Sonic 3 movie. He says to Shadow, it's never too late to do the right thing. And, you know, she's made the decision to do this. She's made the decision to make cuts on the backs of some of the poorest people because of a dumb ass fiscal rule, which, again, I've said that for over a year now. So, you know, what can Scotland do? Because, you know, that is very, it must be getting difficult up there considering that the two-child benefit cap doesn't exist and the bedroom tax doesn't exist. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of questions asked about Anasawa about what are, you know, are they going to cut PIP payments to people in Scotland, or how that's going to work? And, you know, if I was an MP and I was against this, right, I would write to my constituents and say, look, I want a story, as many stories as I can, right, about how this, how these changes will impact you. And every week I'd go in there, I'd be like, this is my constituent from such and such area. He's got such a, they've got such and such problem. How can, you know, you do this to my constituent who did not vote for this? If they wanted these cuts to happen, they would have voted for the Conservative Party. So that's what I would do. But, you know, I think I'll give that question to you guys, which is what can the, I guess the SNP right now, because they're in government, or, you know, what can Scotland really do to mitigate these cuts? They're, you know, Holyrood, what can they do at this point? Because they don't have a lot of budgetary options.
No, they don't. The first thing is we still have the two-child benefit cap. It's only a plan to mitigate that just now, because we need to have the data from the Department of Work and Pensions to make it work up here. Now, we'll get that eventually. We just need to budget better. We're on a fixed budget as it is. When we explain the Barnett formula, it is a fixed budget. Okay, we do have tax raising powers, but there's a little loophole in there where I could not tell you where I've read it, but whereas if we raise a certain amount, our budget is reduced by through the Barnett formula as well for it all. But we do have a more progressive tax system up here, where people that can afford to pay a little bit more. It's still not full fiscal autonomy, and that's what we need. That the only way that we can fix this, okay, is with full fiscal autonomy. That's a perfect case for independence, in my opinion. And I feel that independence, with the revenue streams that we have and the investment we could make, and normal borrowing powers. Scotland can't borrow like a normal country. If we were a normal independent nation, none of this would be happening. Okay, in the same, we might have like modern problems that are slightly different from there, but we wouldn't have arseholes doing stupid things for the fiscal rules that you're talking about. We would have our own things, and trust me, the Scottish people would turn around and like react differently from what's happening down south. Because we wouldn't have that. We fought for independence, so we've got it. So now you're going to just be like little Britain up here? Don't think so. We'll have a whole different system.
If you were independent, you would have stayed in the EU.
Yes.
That's correct. Had the 2014 referendum waited until after the Brexit referendum, that would have gone very differently, because, I'll say it again, in the January of the year before the Scottish referendum, Nicola Sturgeon is on stage constantly getting, if you get independence, if you get your self-determination, you're going to be immediately out of Europe. And she's saying in return, you're about to have a vote, an in-out referendum on the EU. Mm-hmm. And that was a year before the Scottish referendum. Why did they not wait until after that vote that they knew was coming? It was because Alex Salmond was, I've heard it said that his gambling mentality, he was kind of pushed into just doing the thing. He was galled into it, and that was a failure on his part, to be honest.
I think with that as well, David Cameron didn't think that referendum was going to happen either. He thought there'd be a coalition with the Lib Dems again. That was his gamble as well. He thought that he was never going to have to do that vote.
Nicola Sturgeon is literally answering these constant attacks of your immediate with, you're about to have an in-out referendum. And she was very certain about it.
Mm-hmm. She was. Cameron wasn't, and he was the person that was there. That's the problem, because he thought there'd be another coalition. That there was no one more surprised about the Conservative Party winning a majority on that night than David Cameron, because after all the shit he did, he was like, they fucking voted for me again in higher numbers this time, because my man can't eat a fucking bacon sandwich.
I'm gonna have to say it was nice, just on a slightly positive note, to see the Brexit, to see so many MPs in Parliament talking about how crap Brexit's been. I think there were 41 of them, and they lambasted it. I think there were two people that tried to talk well of it. I know one was DUP. I can't remember the other. But that was it. Out of like 41 MPs, they just railed against it. It didn't get any promotion. Unfortunately, we're at an end. That fucking flew by. Thank you so much to our guests. If you've got this far in the video, we must have done something right. So hit that like and subscribe button. And thank you. Bye, everyone. Hail the lamp.
Hail the lamp.
Next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
So, Mo, you're in a Twilight Zone situation, Black Mirror, okay? Mo, you get Scottish independence, but Alex Salmond is First Minister for life.
He's dead.
Or...
we bring him back, we revive him.
Scotland gets to rejoin the EU, but Nigel Farage relocates to Scotland and has a TV show that is on every single day of the week, and it's getting high ratings. He gives you credit for that show. You personally.
Me personally?
You personally, he gives you credit.
No. The show's called Nigel's Corner.
Which do you choose?
Okay, so I'm going to go straight up with Independence, Alex Salmond for life, because Alex Salmond, if he's been resurrected, he's still alive, say, okay, we have independence, we have full autonomy, we can still rejoin the EU. And the man's not going to live forever. Okay,
no,
we will
is.
Have
he,
a
he
different.
Is. We revived him, so he is.
We revived him.
He's not a zombie.
We broke the walls of death.
He's got zombies.
Okay.
Forever.
All right. Forever. It's for life. It's for life. Eventually he will go, and what will happen is they will take me out of deep freeze and make me First Minister. Right? Because I would be an awesome First Minister.
I believe that.
No, it would be President of a Republic of Scotland. Let's just face it, okay?
Jenny.
Hi.
You go into the catacombs of
Paris?
Some Scottish castle.
Some Scottish castle.
Okay, sure.
And you discover Robert de Bruce has left the original recipe for whiskey. It is now 100% Scottish. Except in his notes, after creating it, he calls it a vile poison. Or, your alternative is, in these same catacombs, you can only take one, you discover the original recipe for haggis. It's over 1,000 years old, but you discover that the original, and so lots of pride and everything else, but you discover that the original recipe included rat meat. Which one do you choose?
Whiskey. I'm a whiskey girl. I've never eaten haggis because I can't get past the smell of or look of the thing. So, no, it's going to be the whiskey. But also, whiskey wasn't as big a drink back in Robert the Bruce's era.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know,
the 18th, but whiskey, every time, because haggis is disgusting. And those that eat it are the bravest of Scots.
I quite like it.
Twice a week. Twice a week.
You have it twice a week?
Boggin.
Oh, yeah.
Boggin.
Breakfast haggis.
No.
Sliced breakfast haggis.
No.
With whiskey on the top of it.
I've got about 5 different bottles of varying whiskies in my house at any given moment. And I would suggest that rates higher than your haggis munching.